Whenever there is a dispute, the journalist casts himself or herself in the role of referee at some kind of sports contest and says, well, of course, both sides are to blame.
That sounds balanced, but applied to the government shutdown, it's just not true. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The state of California may have passed a law to ban so-called revenge porn, but lawmakers haven't had much success reining in the internet.
The technology constantly outstrips the pace of legislation. Whatever problem the legislators are worrying about is probably a problem from a few years ago.
Also, once we depended on laugh tracks to tell us how to feel, now we have Twitter, the newest technology to address a very old need.
There's a part of the human brain, the limbic system, that's basically wired to look for meaning in the meaning that other people find.
There's a lot more coming up after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Well, as of Friday, no end in sight. An impasse. Gridlock. So, with no movement in negotiations to end the government shutdown, much of the press was focused on the unfortunate reality of extremely limited government.
For folks coming to New York to see the iconic Statue of Liberty, this may be their last chance. And who knows how long.
Hundreds of patients, some including children with cancer, who want to sign up for clinical trials here, can't.
Some 18,000 NASA employees will be on furlough, many of them right here in Houston.
The whole affair triggered an awful sense of deja vu, recalling bad news memories of 1995 when House Speaker Newt Gingrich thought it might be a good idea to flex his Republican revolutionary muscle against President Bill Clinton.
Neither the president nor the speaker nor Senator Dole will give, so tonight much of the government remains shut down.
Speaking of deja vu, in the coverage of the shutdown, much of the media have once again defaulted to a kind of false equivalency, couching the story as if the overarching fact were two polarized parties unable to compromise. But as The Atlantic's James Fallows fulminated this week, all but sending spittle flying from his text, the current fiasco has little to do with bipartisan bullheadedness.
Whenever there is a dispute, the journalist casts himself or herself in the role of referee at some kind of sports contest and says, well, of course, both sides are to blame. The problem with this case, as it fit into the Procrustean bed of normal journalism, is number one, it was within one party. And number two, it's not really subject to compromise. And here's what I mean. As I think anybody around D.C. knows, but most readers or viewers would not be aware, at any moment in the last month or two, this whole problem could have been averted if Speaker John Boehner had simply let the House of Representatives vote on a clean resolution where you simply say, we're going to allow the money, the government can stay open, and we'll save for some other time disputes about Obamacare. If this had come to a vote, it would pass. The only reason that's not happening is that the more conservative part of Boehner's Republican majority in the House don't want that to happen. You would not have gathered that from some of the early stories about Republicans and Democrats, extremists of both sides, etc. This is a war within the Republican Party.
But there has been coverage, I've seen it, of the fight within the Republican Party. I mean, that's been in our great newspapers.
It's been journalism in all of its chaotic glory. One of the reasons I put so much pressure on the editorialists or the TV commentators who've been saying, oh, let's just pick up the phone and have Speaker Boehner and President Obama work this out, is that if they were reading their own newspapers, if they were listening to some of their own reporters, they would have understood this is something different.
Your big concern is that by falling into the old patterns, there is a profound failure to convey the gravity of the situation, that there is no post-Civil War precedent for what the House GOP is doing right now.
Suppose back in 2005, after George W. Bush had been reelected, and when he still held the Senate, it was still in Republican hands, let's suppose that in that year, Nancy Pelosi and her Democrats had taken over the House. And suppose that Nancy Pelosi did what the House Republicans are doing now, which is saying the government will not continue its operations, and the debt ceiling might not be raised, leading to all sorts of financial repercussions, unless all of the tax cuts that were part of George W. Bush's first big achievement in his first term, were just immediately undone. The extent of the demands and saying that unless we get our way in this point, nothing else can happen, that is new in modern politics.
Let's talk about the Washington Post, because that seems to be your perfect case in point. Earlier in the week, in particular, an op-ed that you called a thing of wonder, and which included the line, ultimately, the grown-ups in the room will have to do their job, which in a democracy with divided government means compromising for the common good. This, you said, was a tour de force of false equivalency.
And it was the more impressive because it wasn't even some op-ed column by some random person. It was the official editorial statement of the newspaper. And it was resolute in its insistence that neither party was being less reasonable, less compromising than the other. It was a matter of just picking up the phone. Remarkably, just 3 days later, the Post had an entirely different official editorial calling by name on Speaker Boehner, on Eric Cantor, and on Paul Ryan of the Budget Committee, quote, to do their job. That, I thought, was quite an impressive and welcome change from the Post part. And always looking on the positive, I'm thinking that the mighty dreadnought of American journalism is rotating its turrets in the correct direction.
Do you think it's partly because of the notion that the press is fundamentally liberal that causes a bending over backwards to deny what is a reality?
I am sure that is the case. Partly because, as we have discussed and everybody knows, every survey shows that more national reporters vote Democratic than Republican. That if Nancy Pelosi had been pulling a similar stunt a decade ago against George W. Bush, I know that many of the editorial boards and reporters would feel entirely free in saying, look, the Democrats are going crazy here. They're being extreme. They're doing things that are unreasonable. I think so great is sort of the instinctive cringe about being accused of left-wing bias that it is harder for analysts and editorialists to say the same thing about Republicans. It's much more comforting for reporters to quote other Republicans saying that. For example, the Republican congressman who said the Tea Party reminds him of lemmings wearing suicide vests than it is to make that observation yourself.
Jim, it was a pleasure as always. Thank you so much.
Brooke, thank you.
Jim Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic.
So the press initially did a lousy job explaining that John Boehner, like little Dorothy, had the power all along to end this shutdown. The media still haven't done a good job giving a sophisticated explanation for why he won't take action. Instead, they quote politician after politician assigning blame. Texas Senator Ted Cruz blamed Majority Leader Harry Reid.
This is Harry Reid's shutdown, and it is the perfect example of liberal arrogance.
Harry Reid blamed the Tea Party.
These people who are elected to represent the country are representing the Tea Party, the anarchists of the country.
And we all blamed the current political class. People, and by people I mean mainly MSNBC's Chris Matthews, love to mythologize the relationship between late House Speaker Tip O'Neill and President Ronald Reagan. They argued mightily, Matthews wrote, each man belting out his separate, deeply cherished political philosophy, but then they both together bowed to the country's judgment. Decisions were made, action taken, outcomes achieved. But does that standard apply to the current circumstances? Dartmouth political scientist Brendan Nyhan says that the press needs to explain that the leaders of 2013 are playing a different game with different rules, including the rules by which they are elected to office.
If you think about Reagan having the opportunity to reach across the aisle to the more centrist members of the Democratic Party, who in a lot of cases were from the South, those folks are no longer in Congress. Lyndon Baines Johnson, we think of LBJ as a master wheeler dealer, but he enjoyed significant partisan majorities in Congress and very unusually internally diverse parties, which made it easier for him to build big coalitions.
I have just seen so little that looks into the political infrastructure of this impasse, beginning with gerrymandering and safe seats. That civics lesson seems to be missing, you say, more on the local level than the national one.
We do see more safe seats, more representatives representing districts where the main threat to re-election is primary rather than a general election. What we need are state and local reporters to go out there and help us understand the political constraints that those members face. Because even if the national polls suggest the current shutdown isn't playing especially well for Republicans, that may not be true in the districts of the members who are driving this current standoff.
What can local reporters do to help us understand how this gridlock has evolved?
There are different things you could do. I mean, one is to actually reach out to those activists and local politicians who might support a potential challenger in a primary, who are in some ways the most important constituency for a member in a safe seat. Those are the folks you'd want to consult with first. Another thing would be to give people some historical perspective on how the local congressional delegations, in terms of the representation of moderates, the proportion of safe seats, basic electoral facts about how the map has changed that could help people understand why they are represented by someone who has a district that went Romney 65-35 or vice versa on the Democratic side.
It seems to me that one of the problems is a lot of the reporting is based on very carefully contrived sound bites from the politicians in the middle of this.
These aren't just sound bites. These are unusually vitriolic sound bites, and reporters love that, right? Leaders squabbling in public in a way that they rarely do.
Certainly no politician is going to say, I don't so much blame Harry Reid and John Boehner as a long-term trend driven by demographics and gerrymandering that has pushed Democrats and Republicans on opposite sides of a yawning ideological canyon. We're not going to hear that from some Republican in the House. So is the press talking to the wrong suspects?
The national outlets standing around the Capitol tend to focus on who said what yesterday, what happened yesterday. And that's essentially the equivalent of zooming way too far in on your microscope. Pulling out might give your readers better perspective because there are some bigger questions we have to think about. How does our government work in a highly polarized era? And some of the institutions of American government aren't especially well adapted to that. Better coverage could help members of the public see where those problems are.
Brendan, thank you very much.
Thanks again.
Brendan Nyhan is a professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. While in the U.S., the media have almost universally glommed onto the blame game narrative to drive coverage of the government shutdown, reaction from around the world has been most diverse. Aviva Shen of the progressive website Think Progress did a roundup of reactions from around the globe. Aviva, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Can we start with Britain?
Anthony Zurcher in the BBC actually made the comparison to Syria and said that even in the middle of this bloody civil war, the Syrian government has continued to pay its bills and workers' wages. And David Cameron even told BBC Radio 4 that it's a risk to the world economy if the U.S. can't properly sort out its spending plans.
And the Daily Mail, the tabloid?
They just said America shuts down in a very dramatic fashion.
There was a lot of criticism, some from obvious friends like Germany, some from troublesome nominal allies like Russia. Give me an idea of the scope of the reaction.
Germany was blaming a handful of radicals. Der Spiegel said that a superpower has paralyzed itself. And another paper said that there would be fatal consequences to the U.S. recovery. And Russia, they were saying that the elephants are robbing the U.S. government, and that the U.S. would be left penniless. And they were worrying about what it would do to Russian visas.
So like the coverage in U.S. media where there's, 10,000 people killed in a monsoon and the headline is about the U.S. citizen who's unaccounted for, the coverage around the world was kind of parochial. The Russians were looking at the visa situation. I think there was something about the International Space Station, too, whether you'd be able to support the cosmonauts. Did that kind of, how does this affect us, ethic, show up elsewhere?
Yeah, well, France was worried about tourists and also American cemeteries that were closed in France. Pretty much every international paper that I saw talked about the impact on tourists. And of course, people are worried about world markets, which have so far stayed pretty steady, but who knows what'll happen if it goes on for much longer.
Tell me about South Korea. They have a particularly significant stake in American fiscal affairs.
Right. South Korea was pretty worried that it was going to affect the military presence in South Korea, that perhaps troops were going to be scaled back. And Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is there right now. He made sure to reassure everyone that budgetary issues were not going to require the U.S. to reduce its military presence in South Korea.
As I looked at the coverage that you excerpted in your post, some of the most forgiving commentary came from China.
Voice of America interviewed a professor at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy in Beijing, and he said that if this were happening in another country, maybe it would be more concerning. But he believes in the maturity of the U.S. government and American politicians to have the wisdom to come to a consensus and solve this issue smoothly, which is a lot more confidence than I've heard elsewhere. Europe may have been a little more critical, in part because the U.S. has been doing so much financial proselytizing on the euro crisis, and I think that they see this as hypocrisy.
Physician, heal thyself.
Yes, exactly.
Aviva, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Aviva Shen is a reporter for thinkprogress.org.
Coming up, how much would you have to be paid to be less partisan?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform designed to provide a simple way to create a website or online portfolio. For business or personal use, Squarespace provides templates and drag-and-drop tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready with 24/7 support, domain names, and e-commerce, all included on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media. And The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about The New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. According to an analysis by marketing firm IHS Global Insight, the government shutdown will cost us about $300 million a day in lost economic output. So, if you wanted, you could call that the cost of political intransigence in the nation's capital. But how much would it cost to make we the people less mulish? Well, according to a study published this summer by the National Bureau of Economic Research, you could pay for it with an Amazon gift card. That's right. Researchers divided volunteers into two groups and asked them basic factual questions about politics. The participants in one group were told that their odds of winning the card increased with accuracy. The other group was just asked the questions. No gift card was mentioned. The possibility of tangible reward boosted accuracy profoundly, says Gregory Huber, who was one of the researchers.
We see divides between Democrats and Republicans on very simple factual matters. How old was Barack Obama when he ran for president? How old was John McCain when he ran for president? But when you pay people, you find that the size of those differences between Democrats and Republicans is substantially smaller.
How much smaller?
About half of the gap between Democrats and Republicans went away.
Did you ever deduct points for getting an answer wrong?
Well, that was the spirit of the second experiment, where in addition to paying people to get the answer right, We said you could get some portion of that amount for simply saying, I don't know. And in that context, we found that the gaps between Democrats and Republicans were about 80% smaller than when you didn't pay them.
Can you give me an example of questions that had more political freight?
The question about the unemployment rate during the first 3 years of the Obama administration. In the condition where we didn't pay people, we found that the gap was about 30 points. And when we paid people for the correct response, it was only about 10 points.
So what does this mean? That lacking the appropriate incentive, people are more likely to lie to themselves?
Well, I think it might mean that when people are answering surveys, they're using the survey not as a chance to try to tell you what they really think, but as a chance to cheerlead for their partisan team. Because if this ends up in the newspaper and it turns out Republicans don't like a Republican policy, that will be used against Republicans.
Therein lies the problem with applying your findings, because you're bringing people into an experiment where their opinions aren't going to be publicly expressed in a poll. So it's a lot easier to abandon your team for $5.
I think that's exactly right. We have an intuitive sense that when people are answering surveys, they aren't necessarily taking themselves too seriously. But we've had a hard time figuring out how large that problem is. And these data suggest that it's perhaps very large. So when you hear extensive reports about Democrats and Republicans having stark disagreements about even the basic facts, maybe we shouldn't be too worried, because maybe they know that they don't really disagree, but the survey data aren't going to allow us to tell that.
So is there any way to put this idea into our drinking water? I mean, what can you do with it?
What to do with it, maybe we should be skeptical that people really believe those responses that they give to a media survey. I think it tells us about what those polls really mean deep down inside. Because if at the end of the day, we thought that Democrats and Republicans looked back at the past and misremembered the facts, we'd be very, very worried about democracy. Instead, it appears that they, to a large degree, understand what really happened. They might still prefer Democrats to Republicans, but it's not because they can't remember what happened or they actually doubt the reality.
Gregory, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gregory Huber teaches political science at Yale University.
California has recently passed two laws meant to protect individuals online from harassment and from themselves. A bill signed into law this week would make revenge porn, the uploading of nude images without the consent of the person pictured, a crime. Late last month, the legislature also passed the so-called eraser law, empowering minors to have embarrassing material removed from the internet. It seems as though California is at the vanguard of internet law, but Eric Goldman, law professor at Santa Clara University School of Law, says the devil is in the details, and there are a lot of details. Eric, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We've talked about revenge porn on our show several times. It's a problem, but does this new law actually address the problem?
At most, it addresses one specific category thing that might be characterized as revenge porn, when someone takes a photo and then goes and publishes it to try and cause harm to the depicted individual. But there are other kinds of things that might qualify as revenge porn, and this law doesn't address them at all. The law doesn't attempt to regulate the websites that allow users to publish content. The law doesn't appear to cover selfies. So if somebody takes a picture of themselves and sends it to somebody else, that appears not to be covered by the law. And the law doesn't cover the fact that once a post is made, other people might copy and paste that post and put it somewhere else. The law also doesn't attempt to address that issue as well.
And even in what it does address, the idea of somehow proving the intent when somebody posts strikes me as a pretty high threshold for conviction of this misdemeanor crime.
The law requires that the government show that the defendant had an intent to cause serious emotional distress. I'm not quite sure what kind of proof is going to be required to show that, but that's a high level of proof. And chances are, if the government has that high level of proof, there's probably other crimes that were committed along the way.
All right, let's talk about the new erasure law. We've talked about the so-called right to be forgotten in the past, But that's also not necessarily a straightforward issue to legislate. How does the California version look, and what are its prospects?
The California law attacks one specific problem. It allows a minor to come back and take down a particular posting that they've made under certain circumstances. The law doesn't apply to any place that the post might have been copied to. It's only with respect to the original post that was made. And as a result, it doesn't allow minors to scrub the internet, which is, I think, what the typical right to be forgotten model is designed to do. So in the end, I'm not sure what this law actually does. It probably doesn't do much except make a whole lot of new complex laws for people to worry about.
Well-intended, though, right? The notion that if you're under 18, you are not mature enough to sign a contract and presumably just too stupid to realize the consequences of careless posting.
We do have a social dilemma here, and a pretty big one. The new generations have the power to publish that older generations never had without having been taught how to wield that power wisely. I'm not sure the legislative solution is going to be the correct fix. And this particular law doesn't actually either prevent kids from putting their foot in their mouth. And more generally, I think that allowing people to rewrite history creates its own sets of concerns. We can't change history. We can make sure that the consequences of history are thoughtfully considered. But if someone does something stupid, in the end, there's only so much that we can do from a legislative solution to remediate that problem.
Now, irrespective of whether the laws are well thought out, when legislation is passed in a state, especially one as populous as California, doesn't that tend to set the bar for the rest of the country?
We really struggle figuring out the implications of a state trying to regulate the internet. The internet is a borderless network. It cuts across not only state lines, but country lines. My guess is that some of the leading social networking sites that are based in California fully intend to comply with the law. But then what about the networks outside of the state? What are they supposed to do? And we don't really have a good answer for that. Now we have to decide, do we care about California or not? And if we do care about California, chances are they reached outside their borders and tried to regulate something that's only Congress's purview.
Is it your sense that the legislature intends to make de facto national law by prominently passing these internet statutes?
California legislators have had a history of thinking that they can fix the nation's problems using the platform of the California legislature, kind of seeking the equivalent of a promotion. They wish they were members of Congress and had federal oversight. They actually haven't been elected to that position.
Whether it's anti-bullying statutes or revenge porn or the eraser law, it strikes me that whenever legislators try to harness the internet, they always screw it up. Either the laws are too restrictive or they have too many holes in them. Has anyone ever successfully figured out how to legislate problematic speech online?
My personal vote is no. And in part, it's because the technology constantly outstrips the pace of legislation. Whatever problem the legislators are worrying about is probably a problem from a few years ago. And technology is going to continue to move in ways that will render the legislative efforts at best historical. When it comes to technological problems, we should not underestimate the ability of technology to potentially solve the problem. And my primary example of this is the spam problem. We had a bunch of legislative efforts 15 years ago to a decade ago designed to fix the spam problem. The reality is what we just needed was better spam filters. Once we got those, spam kind of looks like a very dated problem.
Dated to you, maybe. The Viagra I just bought, I think, is just sugar. I think it's phony.
Yeah, you know, I never deal with the Trinidad-based dealers.
Eric, many thanks.
My pleasure.
Eric Goldman is a professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law.
Last Sunday, AMC aired the final episode of Breaking Bad.
It's over. And I needed a proper goodbye.
If you haven't seen it, we won't spoil it for you, but if you've been on Twitter or Facebook or basically anywhere online since the finale aired, the reaction was inescapable. Twitter said that fans tweeted about the show 100,000 times a day in the run-up to Sunday's finale. Facebook said there have been 23 million interactions about Breaking Bad since August, created by 11 million people. More than 10 million viewed the finale live. How many more like me time shifted, I don't know. But one thing is clear. The internet was a Breaking Bad magnet. And studies show that online discussion not only serves audiences, it builds them. Kevin Slavin is an assistant professor of media arts and sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and co-founder of Everybody at Once. He says that social media have returned something to entertainment that was always there until recorded television. It gave us back to us.
You have to remember that television started off not as radio with pictures, but rather as theater in your home. Basically, it was a live broadcast. It said, okay, something's happening somewhere, and we're going to connect you live to this theater experience.
Well, let's talk about that. I remember when I was a kid watching reruns of the old George Burns show, and he'd come out in front of a curtain, he'd talk to an audience.
How do you like that Jag Benny stealing my opening joke? I was going to take a swing at him, but I didn't want to hit a man with gray hair. But wait till I catch him without it.
That was something that actually people were very familiar with for the early years of television, and it really changed when they could start actually recording shows and start to edit them.
It must make the storytelling better.
It definitely made the storytelling better. You know, Breaking Bad would be a really lousy show if it was live, but what they discovered quite by accident is that when they did that, the ratings in television started to go down.
Because there was no audience depicted in the experience?
There was no sense of the audience. You didn't need to necessarily see them, but there's no sense that anybody else was there. And there's not really a model for that. You know, even think about early radio also had audiences. There was a shift in the technology that allowed us to remove the audience. And it was authentically strange. And a bunch of people sort of rushed in to figure out, what do we do? How do we deal with this? So the first thing they invented was the applause sign. And sometimes if the joke didn't land in the live studio, they would play back the sound of laughter to make it sound like it was a little bit more ambitious.
And this brings us to Charlie Douglas.
Charlie Douglas, who was the sound engineer, who realized, actually, as long as you're sweetening the audience, maybe they don't need to be there in the first place. And he invented basically the laugh track.
I saw some videos on YouTube. Mm-hmm. There were clips from Friends, mm-hmm. but the laugh track had been removed.
Yeah.
In one of them, Phoebe says one of her classic punchlines.
Hey, do you guys want to go see a movie?
Oh, yeah. Why not?
Yeah, Phoebe?
No, thanks. I've already seen one.
In those pauses, you realize how artificial it was to even stand there and wait for a laugh that had to be inserted later. That there's a vast kind of architecture and infrastructure in the production of television just to accommodate a fake audience, which is kind of amazing.
It's a lot easier to fake an audience for comedy than it is for drama.
Right, yes.
And so they never have.
Yeah.
But is that because that experience is less communal anyway? I ask it because it brings us back to Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm.
Why do people need to talk about the TV they're watching while they're watching it?
Well, I think that people need to do that for the same reasons that they needed to hear fake laughter for 60 years, which is that there's a part of the human brain, the limbic system, that's basically wired to look for meaning in the meaning that other people find. This isn't just television. This is all things. This is healthcare systems. This is everything. And now we have these tools, Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, BlackBerry Messenger, that allow us to actually be able to sort of see each other in a way for this moment and actually participate in this communal expression of surprise, horror, laughter, etc. And I think this is, of all of the major shifts in the technologies of entertainment, the ability of the audience to see the audience around themselves is the greatest. It's much bigger than 3D. It's much bigger than high definition. It's actually the restoration of the sense of the audience around us. And I think that's something that nobody was trying to build, and yet it's something that everybody was trying to find.
But today, we can set our DVR to watch a show later in the day or download it for tomorrow or wait for it to go on Netflix and watch it a year later. So what role can social media play in satisfying this need for an audience if our viewing is so out of sync with each other?
If you grew up in an era where there were only a few networks and only certain shows, that sense of sort of participating in something with everyone around you was really, really important. And all of that got left behind the minute we started time shifting. Everything became on demand. And what we see is that people are using these on-demand technologies to run and run and run and run and run to catch up to everybody else who's having a conversation. Breaking Bad is such a good example because just before the premiere of season 5, Netflix made available all of season four online. 50,000 people watched all 13 episodes from season four in one day. 50,000 people is not a lot of people, but think about what's involved there. 50,000 people spent 13 hours out of one day using all the tools that allow us to consume things on our own time, but only in order to enjoy them together.
Kevin, thank you very much.
Thanks to you.
Kevin Slavin is an assistant professor of media arts and sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and co-founder of Everybody at Once. Coming up, the citizens of India put their lives on the line for the right to know.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
Hey, Brooke.
Hi, Kat.
What are you doing?
You can see what I'm doing. I'm crocheting a hat.
But why are you doing crocheting a hat in the studio?
Because it's a break and I try to get out a hat a day. But why are you in the studio?
Well, I'm here to push our newsletter.
Ah, it has not only the rundown of the show, but we have now added extra bits, including some of our TLDR, our new little brainchild.
Yeah, and it's fun. You know, it comes into your mobile phone, whatever. You can read it on the subway. You don't have to download anything. It's a really good primer on what's coming up on the show. And what we're going to combine here is my push for the newsletter, your hat fetish.
Really?
What I would really love you, listener, to do right now is go to our website, go to the top where it says sign up for our newsletter, enter your email address, and you'll get our newsletter and you'll be a subscriber to our newsletter. And it's fabulous. It goes out on Friday. So for the lucky person who has their name randomly pulled from, what should we say, the next 2 weeks, You will get a hat personally made for you by Brooke.
That's fine with me. They're not very good. These are born of compulsion, not artistry. But I'll make it for you. I'll even crochet an OTM on it somewhere if you want.
It's a unique item. Only yours. Only you will own it.
It's a deal.
Okay, good.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Independence Day, the Freedom of Information Act turned 47, and it is, in concept, a thing of beauty. But ask reporters who've waited years to get a request answered or gotten a document redacted nearly to death, and they might suggest that the law isn't exactly living up to its potential. But even if it falls short in practice, it does continue to inspire dozens of countries who have created their own transparency programs. This summer, OTM reporter Jamie York went to India, a relatively new adopter of what they call the right to information, to see how it's working in the world's largest democracy.
It's a Tuesday in New Delhi, India, a balmy 100 degrees in late June, and Subhash Agrawal is where you'll find him most days, in a municipal office complex trying to fight corruption. He's using India's right to information, or RTI laws. Today, he's targeting a local city planning agency that he believes has misappropriated funds.
Then it is necessary, in public interest, that your affairs should be transparent.
Then, as is his habit, he returns to his house at the back of an alley in a very old part of town. India's government is corrupt at every level, limited only by the creativity of the perpetrators. But Agrawal, a feisty man in his 60s, has developed a system for tackling that. He scours the newspaper for clues to government malfeasance.
Something fishy and suspicious.
Then he makes a ruckus. Agrawal holds the Guinness World Record for the most published letters to the editor. It's true. Agrawal's mission began in earnest 7 years ago when he saw a presentation at his Rotary Club about the new RTI laws. Since then, he says he's filed 6,000 requests for information, and he feeds what he finds to the press. It's his passion.
We decided not to have any child. Live for the society, not for yourself. So we two, my and my wife, are totally devoted to the social cause. We have no hobby of going to movies and going to outings and going on holidaying. No, I am a single man army. I am an ordinary man using RTI Act.
That's half true. Agrawal is an ordinary man, albeit one with an unusually patient wife and a Guinness World Record, but he's not a single man army. There are millions of foot soldiers across India filing information requests under a law that was created for them by them. That army was born here in Rajasthan, a large state in India's northwest corner. It's hot, parched, rural. 27 years ago, three activists, one of them a Rajasthan native, moved to an isolated village here, vowing to live simply, like Mahatma Gandhi, and to identify and address the issue the community cared most about. Nikhil Day, one of those activists, said it didn't take long to figure it out.
It's all single crop area, so it's rain-fed agriculture. So primarily one crop a year, if the rains fall at the right time, and otherwise there's great vulnerability and possibilities of drought.
And starvation. So when crops won't grow, men leave the women and children and go in search of work, sending home pay if they can. The village women also needed work, and Day's organization, called the MKSS, fought for some promise of employment from the federal government. After years of struggle, they won. The rural poor across India are now guaranteed 100 days a year of manual labor whenever they need it at minimum wage. It was a tremendous victory. There was just one problem. Nikhil Day.
To make a very long story very short, they said, why are we not getting our minimum wages? The answer was, well, you haven't worked. And they would say, well, we've worked 8 hours. Where have we not worked? So the answer was, measurements show you haven't worked. So show us those measurements. And the answer was, no, these are bills and vouchers and these are secret documents. So people, while they were agitating, we went through 2 hunger strikes asking for minimum wages. They realized that the key to get that wage meant first getting those records out.
Day says it's the poorest women like these who bear the brunt of corruption. A lack of information affects every part of their lives.
Hum janenge, hum jiyenge. The right to know, the right to live. I cannot get my wage unless I know. I cannot get my rations in the ration shop and my wheat unless I know how much and when it's come and who it's gone to. I cannot get my medicines in the hospital unless I know.
So a group of poor rural women fought for their village records. This song is a kind of anthem. Directions for listeners, many illiterate, and exactly how to file RTI requests. Local officials were in a bind. Refusing to release documents would make them appear corrupt. Complying would prove it. So they stalled. But as the community fought in the courts, the women acquired some of the relevant information.
Not quite stealing, but as close to that as you could. Copying down surreptitiously. And placed those records in front of the people and read them out.
That was revolutionary. Armed with the documents, everyone, including the corrupt local officials, were invited to a public meeting.
It's your money, it's your accounts, it's your development. If you think it's right, say so. If you think it's wrong, what's happened is not in fact taken place, say so. And that dramatically changed the dynamic in the entire area.
Corrupt officials held 2 sets of books, one factual, one public. The public record showed that someone was paid when they weren't, or a road was built and paid for when it wasn't. Read that to the community, and it's bound to be challenged. Now, 20 years later, the law requires that records be made public. So much so that in rural India today, ledger books are literally painted on the walls to be fact-checked by the community. Again, Nikhil Day.
In Rajasthan, there'll probably be 150,000 such walls. So let's say I get a house under housing program or I get a job under the employment guarantee program. It shows how much money I've received, how many days I'm supposed to have worked. Shows that, so not only can I check my own, but everyone else walking by can check anyone else's. Oh, this guy actually is in Bombay. How come he's shown as working here?
After years of demonstrations, hunger strikes, and sit-ins, this community's right to information demands were made law in Rajasthan and then nationwide in 2005. Under the RTI law, anyone can request information from any government office or official. Most information is due within 30 days. Fines for late delivery are paid by the tardy official. Now, millions of activists, like Subhash Agrawal, pursue information across India, but they risk their lives to do it, especially in rural areas. Aruna Roy is another co-founder of Day's activist group, the MKSS.
We have an overlay of democracy and democratic institutions on a feudal society, because we have a caste system which still operates.
Which means, she says, that the people with the least had never felt able to question anything.
So in this complex system, any questioning of the non-delivery of health, non-delivery of food services, non-delivery of wages, non-delivery of work, non-delivery of schools, non-delivery of anything at all became a huge political issue. And it could end up in a kind of violence because it threatens the status quo.
According to some RTI monitors, at least 24 RTI activists were killed and almost 100 were assaulted from 2005 to 2011, the last date that comprehensive records were kept. Many more have been threatened. Though Aruna Roy and others in Rajasthan have been attacked, they say they never really felt threatened because of their numbers. But how do you protect millions of individuals across India? Shailesh Gandhi is an activist who, much to his surprise, was appointed to the commission that reviews RTI appeals in Mumbai. One of his first acts was to introduce whistleblower protections.
I said if any RTI user believes he's been attacked or threatened or killed, unfortunately, because of usage of RTI, that person, or in the case he's dead, his family, can approach the commission and say, these are the RTIs which somebody is trying to get me off. And the commission would order that the information sought by such a person should be put up on the websites.
But that mechanism works only if somebody has already been hurt or killed. There are tactics that can protect RTI filers in advance. Many people can file the same RTI application anonymously, or you can send it to someone in another state who files it from afar. In India, cell phone usage is almost universal, so RTI activists can also defend themselves by networking. Aruna Roy.
The press of a button, everybody knows what's going on. We know immediately that somebody has been attacked. There are connects now between all of us, and we speak for each other.
All of these tactics can help shield RTI users, but with so much corruption buried in so many documents, can they really make a difference, one RTI request at a time? The answer, if there is one, lies here in Andhra Pradesh, a rural state in India's southeast. It's the home of RTI activist Soumya Kadambi. Here, the local government decided to apply an untested part of the national RTI law, the social audit. This state agreed to preemptively release all the information in a village if Soumya Kadambi would organize a team to check every last transaction. The government figured they'd catch some corrupt local officials. The local officials assumed that releasing fake records would get the rookies off their case.
And so they said, yeah, take the records. And I think I saw the cleanest pieces of paper. We started doing our verification, starting taking these records to people and asking them, so your name's on this muster roll. Did you work? Did you get the money that's been mentioned here? And they go, no, we haven't worked even one day and we haven't received this money.
That's what makes this a social audit rather than merely a financial one. After demanding the records, Kadambi and her team go from every door to every door and visit every public work. There's nowhere for corruption to hide.
We went and audited 6 civil works in about 3 villages. We found that in village after village, money that had been siphoned off was close to about 95%.
In just the last 4 years, Kadambi and her team have conducted social audits across the state and uncovered billions in embezzled rupees. She's organized an army of volunteers, young men and women, 18, 19 years old, from the same impoverished class and dispossessed caste that bears the brunt of corruption.
Today, there are about 120 social audits taking place across 22 provinces. So far in the last 6 years, we've trained more than 100,000 youths.
Those youths are purposely sent to audit communities that aren't their own. They arrive in a village en masse, and they have the backing of the state government. They've exposed plenty of corruption, but suffered no violence.
Why is it that we've not had even one person being killed or shot? Why is it that we've not had someone who's been maimed or hit? It's because the state has stood there, and the minute you get even one threat, the government moves in, swoops onto that person and says, you have no business doing this.
Andhra Pradesh is the first state that's made a concerted effort to implement the social audit provision in the RTI law. And with a population of 85 million people, it stands as a success on a grand scale. So much so that the federal government is thinking about implementing the tactic nationwide. While I was reporting this story, I kept hearing some version of this fable to make a point. The one from Rajasthan goes like this. A rich man is asleep at home and he's awakened by a mouse running across his stomach. He begins to scream, waking everybody up. They come running and ask, why are you yelling? When he replies that a mouse ran over his stomach, they roll their eyes. That's idiotic. It's a mouse. Get a grip. Nikhil Day.
He said, you don't understand. Today the mouse ran. I'm not worried about the mouse. I'm worried about the snake that's coming behind.
In fact, this version was told to me on the floor of an earthen house inherited when the last owner died of a snake bite. It's not an idle metaphor. Activists use this story to explain the power of simple tactics, and in their telling, RTI is the snake.
So why is this entire system reacting when we're asking for something small? It's because they recognize what's coming next.
In a new book, the Nobel Prize-winning Indian economist Amartya Sen tries to figure out why India has failed its poor. The reasons, he concludes, are legion. But one of the few hopes is RTI, especially when it's accompanied by the sharp bite of social audits. Its real power, he concludes, in the hands of the powerless. And it provokes. But as Gandhi might have assured the activists, it also prevails. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York.
Recently, advocates of the RTI law won a sort of victory, or maybe a reprieve. India's six national political parties had sought to amend the law so they would be exempt from its mandates. But Vice President Rahul Gandhi, who's running for prime minister, has increasingly opposed the move, and public opinion has forced the government to once again refer the bill to a standing committee of the parliament, where it has remained for the duration of the monsoon season. That generally ends in September, so the argument is poised to begin again.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Gurkman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Megan Tehan and Zach Spencer. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Justin Gerrish. That was the last time we'll read Jamie York's name. He has been a producer at On the Media for 10 years. And he's kind of a genius. He's also a charmer, and we're going to miss him.
But that's not the last you'll hear from him. He's got another India piece for us, and he'll be over at Radiolab. Good luck, Jamie. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, and you should, or check out our new internet love child, TLDR, which offers daily posts and audio about the weirdness of the internet on our website, onthemedia.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters.
In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.